Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it. That well is now flowing at 2,000 barrels and it's paying me an income of $5,000 a week. I have two others drilling and I have 16 producing at Antelope, so... Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, you have a great chance here. But bear in mind, you can lose it all if you're not careful. Out of all men that beg for a chance to drill your lots, maybe 1 in 20 will be oil men. The rest will be speculators. That's men trying to get between you and the oil men to get some of the money that ought by rights come to you. Even if you find one that has money and means to drill, he'll maybe know nothing about drilling. He'll have to hire the job out on contract, and then you're depending on a contractor. Rush the job through so he can get another contract just as quick as he can. This is the way that this works.
Well, what is your offer? We're wasting time.
Yes. Please.
I do my own drilling. And the men that work for me, and they are men I know. I make it my business to be there and to see their work. I don't lose my tools in the hole and spend months fishing for them. I don't botch the cementing off and let water in the hole and ruin the whole lease. I'm a family man. I run a family business. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview. We offer you the bond of family that very few oil men can understand. I'm fixed like no other company in this field, and that's because my Coyote Hills well has just come in. I have a string of tools already to put to work. I can load a rig onto trucks and have them here in a week. I have business connections, so I can get the lumber for the derrick, such... Things go by friendship in a rush like this. And this is why I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, no matter what the others promise to do, when it comes to the showdown, they won't be there.
Well, welcome to I Know Movies and You Don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Brule, and we are continuing our study of the Western. Actually, this episode follows a very particular Western we just talked about, Giant. Another movie about with a pretty much amoral oil baron at the center of it, and how wealth and riches leads to seclusion and isolation. And there's something, you know, kind of tethered to the movie we're talking about today, There Will Be Blood, another movie about unscrupulous speculators and the kind of denial of traditional morality at the center of it, and what is probably one of the most phenomenal acting performances of all time, one of the most well shot, choreographed and realized epoch of film that is kind of a representation of what the American frontier was. And this, a lot of conversations throughout this season have been about what is the West and what is this time period. And it's a time period of change, and there's a lot of progress, there's a lot of development and change, and some of those are not necessarily good, some of them are bad, and then there is kind of the connection of the two, and that sometimes with, you can't have a really successful birth really without some blood. And you know, with moving itself into a forward momentum, into a progressive state, you know, we have in a character a representation of the frontier, you know, challenged by the frontier, built by the frontier, became
broken by the broken. Frontier.
He became just as ruthless and just as hardened because this was a man against God, man against nature, and the conquering of nature lends itself to becoming something of gives oneself kind of a heightened sense of their own self-interest, their own pioneering ways, and that's the kind of why There Will Be Blood, even though it's moving in from a transition from the frontier to kind of development of the modern day and the modern age, and you see it over the time period that this epic takes place. It really is about how this is a man of that era, fashioned by that era, and what does that mean, and how do they carry themselves in a moral or lack of moral sense. And I mean, there is no other character that is pretty Nietzschean, I would say, than Daniel Plainview. And he's a kind of an embodiment of that philosophy, or the denial of a traditional moral philosophy. And at the center of it is a dynamic drama between the two sorts of philosophies and how they ushered in kind of the new age. And it's going to be, I think, a very good conversation. I'm being joined today by two Bens, actually.
So yeah.
It's the Ben episode. But with me inside the studio, Mr. Ben Thalen, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is your first Western. This is a good. I thought of you for this one. I actually.
I always don't know how to take it when you say you think about me for these movies about terrible people.
Well, I think that we always have great conversations, and I think he is kind of a representation of a very particular kind of American archetype. And and so when I thought of that, I was like, you know, Ben has lofty ideas, and he's very eloquent with that. So.
I do. Yeah. No. I mean, I do think we've all got a little Daniel Plainview in us, maybe. And I certainly found on the rewatch, I found myself more sympathetic to his general hatred for people. Really, just
I do too.
I would say that when I first saw it, I was a younger man and single, and now that I have a kid, I do sort of feel sympathetic to loving your kid and just hating everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, he's very specific with it. He's like, I hate most people, and you know, I don't want most people to succeed.
Yeah.
And it's like, I want no one else to succeed, but I hate people. He tells his faux brother, his imposter brother, half brother, that he hates people and he can't stand the sight of them. And you know, there's something I think I connect with that mentality a little bit too. You know, more people I deal with, this kind of idea that people are hell kind of emerges, and then you look around and you're like, yeah, I hate most people. There's only a select amount of people that I really would like to be around.
Yeah, no, he puts it out there, though. I mean, you got to respect that about him.
That was actually the very first glimpse to this movie that I ever got. They played that clip on NPR before the movie had come out.
Someone's this NPR fancy guy.
Yeah, an NPR memory from 2007, too, because it stuck with me, because they played that one conversation. Really, it's just a monologue of him describing his hatred. And it ends with him saying, I can't keep doing this with these people. That was all I needed to hear, though. I was captivated that little clip of it.
And it's not surprising that they would use that on NPR, because it's not exactly a dialogue heavy movie.
No. Yeah, it's very atmospheric. Very much a soundscape film.
Yeah, I mean, you hit 15 minutes before anyone says a word, and mm-hmm. I mean, all of the best dialogue comes at the end of the movie, which I don't think you could play right in a like it would be a bit of a spoiler.
Yeah,
the ultimate scene, which is for my money maybe the best scene in American cinema. I mean, it's up there. The final scene in this movie, I'm sure we're going to talk about it.
It rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
Well, a lot of people suck, right? I mean, a lot of people suck. I think
let's not try to get too Plainview-ish here.
Kyle knows me. I just like to dive right in. I rewatched the movie, of course, and it was better than I remember it being. Because what sticks with you is that last sequence, right? I think that last sequence, you know, from the time it flashes forward to him sitting in his I mean, you have that brief wedding scene, but then when you get to him and he's sitting in his living room, just shooting, just he's built a shooting gallery in his living room. From that point on till the very end, to me is just tour de force filmmaking. I just can't. Anybody who's rubbed the wrong way with that, get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here. That's just fucking tour de force filmmaking.
When you read conversations about this movie, you get all these, you know, kind of great thoughts that people have where they're, you know, really just blown away by what they've seen here. And then smattered in there, you get these people just going, this movie fucking sucked. I don't know what you liked about it. Like, why the hell did they kill the guy at the end? I don't get any of this.
These people have got to be fucking insane.
Well, I think they are. I think these people are also reacting to the fact that so many of us love this movie.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I was telling
Kyle, there's always people like that. There's always contrarians who are like, who put stock in not liking something that other people like, because that just proves how fucking sophisticated they are. I mean, that's become even more true in the past, you know, since this movie came out, right, with the advent of Twitter and hot take culture. And it's how, like, if you can be the first one who comes up with a take about why you hate something that everyone else loves, there's a lot of currency in that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's always been true amongst a certain kind of certain kinds of assholes. That, you know, if you can be like, oh, this thing that everybody loves, it sucks. If you can be that guy, you can, then I guess, I don't know, pat yourself on the back.
I've always had a disdain for that type of person. Unless they can give me a good reason why they believe it. It's just faux
intellectualism. That's all it is. It's faux intellectualism. In fact, one of the thoughts I was having when I came over about talking about this movie, I think there's a lot to talk about. I think there's a lot to say about this movie. But also, to me, this movie is so great. Like, I feel like the easiest movies to talk about sometimes are ones that are good.
Yes.
Right? Like, we talked about Stranger Than Paradise. That's a good movie, but it's got a lot of issues. And so you can hash that out and think about, like, well, this doesn't really work for me. That doesn't really work for me. I feel like there's a certain kind of movie that is, like, so good. And this movie falls into that category for me. That it's kind of hard to, like... There are aspects of it that are hard to talk about because I don't even know where I would take issue with this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in regards to easy to talk about, me and Kyle, we did Cutter's Way not too long ago.
Yeah.
Which we both love for its ambiguity. It could be read this way or that way. And this movie has so many moments that have this ambiguity where it's like, for instance, did H.W. know that Henry was an imposter when he burned down his cabin?
What did he see
in the book?
Yeah,
I mean, all these little moments. Is HW actually his son? I mean, I definitely don't think that, but that's one of the ambiguities. It's not even addressed.
Just a bastard does, in a basket. Just a bastard Bandy, in a basket.
Does Bandy know that Plainview just shot Henry the night before when he meets him as he wakes up? None of these things are explicitly stated.
Yeah, it's assumed.
You to talk about these
yeah,
things.
There's yeah. a lot of assumption. I actually, the other Ben that you're hearing, I have not introduced actually on the show.
Mr. Ben Childs.
I always do this. I always jump in and just start running my mouth.
Why not just jump right in? they should know me by now.
Oh, no, it's perfectly fine. This kind of fluidity, it's already kind of promising that we'll just keep this going. But Mr. Ben Childs, I wanted to get, you know, obviously you are a fan and you actually you know wanted to get on this particular episode because you are of the opinion that this is one of the best films of the last last century, the last
20 years. I'd say the best film of the 21st century that I've seen, and right up there with its kind of sister movie No Country for Old Men.
It's a great film. Yeah,
and go into why it's why they are intrinsically linked, I think, in a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, they were filmed in the same place, almost at the same time. Actually, I think you can see the smoke from the shot of the oil rig in No Country for Old Men in the background.
That's funny.
I mean, they were both. Everybody was wondering who's going to win the Oscar in 2007. Is it going to be, you know, There Will Be Blood or No Country for Old Men? Nobody else was really even considered, even though I think you mentioned what Zodiac came out that same year.
Zodiac came that's Assassination of Jesse James with the coward Robert Ford came out that same year. Another great poetic kind of Western, and it's hard. It was a hard year to be considered. I mean, this is a truly great piece, and
it's funny, right? Because I did think a lot about this, sort of that year, 2007. the obvious companionship between this and No Country for Old Men. But another movie that came out that year, which I think if I were going to fill out a sort of Americana trilogy about kind of American moral ambiguity, the third movie I'd add from that year would actually be Michael Clayton.
Oh, Michael Clayton's very... that was one that eluded me. Like, I when I first saw it,
I
was
like... That surprises me. I feel like that movie would be right up your alley.
Well,
it's sort of the Chinatown of the 21st century. The screenplay is sort of universally regarded as being sort of a genius screenplay.
I mean, it is a great screenplay. And it was one that eluded me at the time and in previous rewatches over the years. Yes. It fits right in there. And there are very different time periods and they take place. And they're kind of this moral ambiguity of American history. Yeah.
Sort of a trilogy of movies occurring.
Wait, what's the other one of the trilogy?
Michael Clayton. So it would be No Country for Old Men. There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men, Michael Clayton, all in the same year.
Sort of a trilogy of movies about kind of late 19th to early 21st century America, about kind of amorality, about moral ambiguity, about sort of these...
Oh, yeah.
Each of them being sort of driven by these very kind of weird, I don't want to say weird, but these very amoral characters who, and it's funny because I was thinking Michael Clayton in its way could almost be like a quasi-Western because he's a hired gun, right? He's a hired gun, right? He is sort of a man with no name or Yojimbo for like the 21st century white collar class, right?
Yeah.
He's the guy that you call in and he's a fixer, right? And so, to me, I was thinking about those three movies. And the sort of through line from Michael Clayton back through Anton Chigurh, who is the Javier Bardem character in No Country for Old Men, to Daniel Plainview. Right? These three people who in very different ways, I feel like, embody a kind of American amorality,
like a survivalist mentality in a world that because the morals are ambiguous, because there's kind of a wholly understood line, or that they're breaking away from what was kind of understood in the past or what was understood in the time, like they're kind of fashioning a new mentality, a new philosophy for the future.
But it's funny, right? Because you said, you know, early on, I don't know if it got recorded or not, that you were always more of a No Country fan. I was always more of a There Will Be Blood fan, and part of that, I think, is because I like Plainview. I think Plainview is a more interesting character than Chigurh.
Sure.
Chigurh is just like, he's just like a force of nature. Like, it's never really clear why he does what he does.
Yeah. And to me, so he's existentialist.
And so,
yeah.
But
he's like the wrath of God.
Yes, he is much more a stand-in or a symbol for something, right? Like,
it is interesting that Daniel, the name Daniel actually means judgment by God.
Well, there you go.
Maybe Chigurh is that judgment.
Yeah, but, no,
the, you know, the continuing he judgment.
He seems to be more of a kind of this haphazard wrath where it's like it could hit anybody at any time, or you might get skipped over because it might come up tails for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas he's a very kind of pigeonholed sort of character in that regard. Yeah. That's all he is throughout the whole movie is that. And just
very much
unstoppable.
It was kind of funny for me, though, rewatching it. I actually liked Plainview more than I remembered liking him. I found him to be a more sympathetic character than I remember finding him. Probably, like I said, because it's that last scene that really sticks with you, that you sort of discount the character that he was through most of the rest of the movie, who's a much more ambiguous character. And I think the other reason, and I was shocked when I looked back to see that this guy didn't get a nomination for Best Supporting Actor, is that the Paul Dano character is just so fucking hateable.
So good. Yeah.
He is just, his face is just so punchable. Just this scene where he gets sort of beaten up in the oil puddle is just so satisfying. You're like,
I'm going to bury you. I'm going to bury you.
How about the shit?
The next scene where he hasn't washed up at all and he's just sitting at the dinner table with his father, just glaring at his father. He's not touching his food.
And then he takes it out on his father because he's a weaker man.
But also, yeah,
it's really just because he's frustrated.
Yeah,
it's just because he just got beaten down, and he needs to take that out on somebody else.
He can't.
I mean, he is a terrible person.
Well, so this is where the dynamic of this movie comes in, and I actually am leaning far more in the. I think Daniel Plainview is kind of there's more layers of sympathy to him, and if you looked at the kind of the the entirety of the film. I mean, that opening that Mr. Thalen talked about in the opening, that's 15 minutes, is pretty much unspoken words. It's all visual. It's all soundscape. I mean, to see a man down in a hole by himself in pure isolation. I mean, the movie opens with a man in isolation. It ends with him in isolation. I mean,
in the ground like oil, too.
Yeah, in the ground like oil. I mean, there are allusions and similarities from the opening of this film to 2001, A Space Odyssey. And very much, I think it was a conscious choice. Like the dawn of man in 2001, dawn of man really in this, like the kind of new age and how he represents. Yeah. And that the monolith is kind of black oil in this. And there's a similarity in how it's structured, but what's I think really there are admirable qualities to Daniel Plainview. Not all of us have that kind of ambition, drive to put ourselves in danger, to put ourselves in through to break our leg and then carry ourselves out of a hole just for a bit of silver, and then to propel ourselves down the road in sort of a sense of ambition.
That opening scene, I don't think has ever struck such a clear chord of what your main character is made of, like the, you know, what kind of grit he has, where, because I mean, not only does he withstand the broken leg and hauls himself out of that mine, but the camera just pans up to show you he is completely fucked out in the middle
of nowhere. He's in the middle of nowhere,
and he's dragging himself. You know, he's gonna have to drag himself out of this. I've actually gone to an old mine out in Joshua
Tree. As have I.
And it is like a 20-mile ride through nothing. Oh, you know, just. He must have, that trip, you know, dragging himself back must have taken him a day at least. But it just cuts to him making it back. It just assumed that, he's the type of person who will
make it back. He's got the grit. He's got the ability. But what I'm trying to set up here is that there are some admirable qualities to his drive and to his resilience and that survivalist spirit. And I think whether he becomes the monstrous, amoral entity that he does, mostly because I think wealth allows him to be the person he wanted to be, rather, because I don't think he changes. Mm. I think at the beginning, he's that same person. He doesn't want to be around people, but he uses people and works with people, partners up because he has to.
Yeah,
He breeds through this kind of self-interest some progress. The community builds, people are kind of come together. And Eli, who has the punchable face, who is the person who is at odds with this character throughout the entire thing, he's a leech. He's this religious leech. He's this Elmer Gantry kind of character, just pulling everyone, using the piety of the people and their Christian faith to enhance himself. He has the same motivation as Daniel Plainview, but Plainview has kind of tangible outcome. Well, there's not tangible outcome with the religious side. And so I think by the end, when there's a kind of a celebration of him beating the shit out of him to death with a bowling pin, because he's the worst of the entities between the two who are vying for the soul of this nation.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting, there's so much to get into about what you just said. That's an interesting reading of the final
sequence. Yeah, I was going to say, I have a couple points
I think that you could definitely read the moral of the final sequence is that capitalism is the force that will black out everything else no matter what.
Sure, right? There's that
like,
too. Yeah.
Like everything will be co-opted eventually. The false sort of, if you want to use like kind of classic like screenwriting type language, the false defeat, right, is where he claims that he's a believer so he can build the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a false defeat for capitalism to religion. And then the true victory comes at the end when he beats the dude to death.
Yeah.
But there is one part that I take issue with. He does love HW. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The moment where he says, you know, mm-hmm. I abandoned my son is the only honest moment in that baptism sequence where you can tell, and it's just driven by a Daniel Day-Lewis performance, which, now, as you say, is
the question is
as,
what is
as good as anything that's ever been done.
What is the content of his love, though?
Well,
the question that people have brought up is that does he love HW or does he love what HW gives to him? Which is sort of life after death. If he can pass everything he has down to HW, because he needs blood in his life. He needs family. He ships HW off as soon as he has a replacement in Henry. And as soon as Henry is, you know, oh, that's not going to work out, bring HW back. So does he really, I mean, I do see love in his eyes at times.
Oh, I think there's a through line.
A selfishness driving.
Oh yeah, no, I think there's a through line that there's a genuine moment when he's looking at that baby and the baby touches his face. You can't tell me that that's not a genuine tender moment, and that does not necessarily carry on to that end. When he's saying he's a bastard in a basket, it's because he's hurt. He's hurt by this denial of him.
And I feel like when he says in that scene, well, you were just a pretty face I could take to buy land. I don't think anyone believes that, right?
I think the ending lines are way over the top.
Yeah.
But the question is,
he's lashing out.
Really
he's retaliating.
There's so much interesting about. The whole end sequence we could talk about forever, but HW comes to him to try to reconcile, right? And it's clear HW is the most likable character in the movie, right?
Yes.
And he says, you know, I'd rather have you as a father than as a boss or whatever. And that seems very honest, right? And it does seem like he's legitimately trying to reconcile. Like it's not like he's coming to him for something the way that Paul Dano will, the way that the fake brother did before. He's coming
or
to him.
Henry. Yeah.
He's coming to him for some kind of emotional, real reconciliation. And one of the genius parts of this movie is that there's this huge period of time that is elided, right? For us to sort of think about, what happened between the two of them.
14 years or so,
Yeah,
right?
There's this huge period of time that's just elided, right? And part of that, I think, it's smart in a lot of different ways because it's like, Maybe there's probably a lot that would be hard to depict in that period that wouldn't just come across as kind of melodrama, but also it just gives that whole scene a sense of just this tremendous ambiguity, mm-hmm. in stark contrast to what follows,
yeah.
right? Which
and
is
it,
a
well,
very sort of
that
he's lit is literally there's literal
that
bludgeon
period,
in the, in
yeah.
the next sequence.
Yes. And that period that they do away with is really just, okay, he's gotten all of his success right before that period, right before they kind of, fast forward 14 years. He has just finished building his pipe. He has gotten everything he's wanted. He's conquered the world. What comes from conquering the world? Just as he tells the Standard Oil people, what would I do then? If you give me $1 million,
yeah.
then
well,
what
and
am
he,
I going to do?
But and he, it's funny
because...
Because he knew what was going to happen.
Is what he's going to do.
He knew what was going to happen. He knew
right,
he'd be fucking miserable. Right. That's the funniest part
well,
of it. Right.
Well, yeah.
He says it. He's like, "What am I?
Actually,
if I'm not out here doing this shit, what am I going to do? Well, be fucking miserable." Right.
This gets at actually, Paul Thomas Anderson did an interview, I think on also on NPR. Sorry, on Fresh Air.
It's okay. We're okay with NPR. Well, I'm okay. Kyle probably hates NPR.
The very first. I'm just pigeonholing myself though, aren't I? But the very first thing he mentioned about the character was that these oil men tended to start out as prospectors, silver and gold prospectors. And I mentioned this to you, Kyle, about how what they were going for was not necessarily big riches and be able to build the house on the hill. What they were going for was always that next big score. That feeling of the score was what felt great. And after you got that, and maybe you got that and you got tons of riches with it, you're left with an empty feeling because you need that. That's what makes you feel good. And he's at his happiest when he's getting a big score.
Yeah, no,
and,
it's an addiction.
He doesn't know what to do with himself otherwise.
Well, and that's another thing to remember about the context of this situation. The people who went west were fucking freaks. They were freaks and weirdos and people who couldn't fit in. The story of America
right.
is a story.
I mean, it's a story where.
Like the reason that 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century America didn't go as badly here as it did in Europe, where they ended up killing each other twice over, right, is because we had the West. Like World War I, World War II, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Europe, which in many ways
is...
So we could always just push our fucking religious lunatics and weirdos and antisocial shitheads, just push them West. Right, and this movie,
which represents the end of that,
right? Because this movie is about getting to California, mm-hmm. right? This movie is about the birth of California, which of course fits in with Paul Thomas Anderson's general obsession with California.
Yeah,
and some of his best movies
been
made about California. This is a movie about the birth of California. California as a major force in American economics does not begin with entertainment; it begins with oil.
Yeah.
you know. And there's oil here to this day. I was driving out to the Sequoias, and there's still oil derricks out there pumping up oil.
Actually, I wanted to mention a couple things. First off, you mentioned about the dichotomy between Eli and Daniel, and you know which one is more evil or which one is a worse character. Let's say one thing I noticed is that Eli really is—he's looking back and determining what is the best way I can control people. What's the best way to accumulate power and control others? He's looking back and using religion for that. Daniel is looking forward towards the 20th century when we are going to need oil and we are going to rely on oil and we are going to rely on major capitalists to propel us forward in terms of progress. And that really ties to, you know, because Eli fashions himself as the third revelation, which is the, you know, a line of Moses, Jesus, and then apparently him.
Question mark.
But really it's Moses, Jesus, and this massive expansion that we've had through capitalism. I mean, the 20th century was a very different century than the whole 19 that came before it. And really, we did away with God, and we kind of adopted just progress.
Money is the American Jesus, well, right?
Yeah,
It's hard to argue with kind of the conclusion that this movie seems to strongly suggest, right? Which is that at the beginning of the movie, the Eli character, it's not 100% clear what motivates him. And you could at least think that maybe he had real religious faith. His transition is much...
He seems smarmy to...
He's definitely smarmy. He's totally punchable and hateable. But his transition from the first part of the movie to the end is much more dramatic than even Daniel's.
I think, just like... I've thought about this movie, how there's... Is there any character development in this movie? And I don't know if there is...
There's descent and degradation.
Well, I think the characters just reveal themselves more and more and more.
Well, yeah, I mean,
what you see at the end was always there.
I think that's but that's true of, you know, character is revealed through whatever. Like, I think that's true. Like, it's generally true in stories, right? That like the seeds of whatever the person ends up with, even if they quote unquote develop, were present from the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, when I was thinking about this movie and my favorite movies of the 21st century. I started going back by decade. And like I said, what were my favorite movies in the 90s? And I think one that came up on your horror list was I'm not even going to use this as an example, but I just wanted to mention it, is Silence of the Lambs. But the other one that came to mind immediately was Schindler's List. I mean, everyone says it's their favorite, but it really is a great movie. And Schindler really does go through this massive change where at first he's just a capitalist trying to get money, and slowly, inch by inch by inch, he cares more and more and more. And you see him caring more and more by what he talks to other people about, what comes to his mind when he wants to talk to other people. In this one, he doesn't care more and more and more. Really, you just see how he never cared all that much. You also, I think somebody mentioned that his success allows him to be who he always wanted to be to start with. But yeah, I don't see as much character development in this movie as I do see just like a... You're just slowly peeling back all of those things that were hidden.
Well, it depends on who you look at. I think
Eli and the two.
Yeah, I mean Eli. I think it depends on how you. As Mr. Thalen over here was saying, I have to say last names because you're both Ben. So just to make it clear, but we've mentioned that he's smarmy, but at the beginning. You might get the sense that he's overly zealous because he believes. He's like a thorough believer, and so therefore there's an understanding that perhaps he's not as conniving, as money grubbing as Plainview is, and it's the last scene that kind of reveals that. I think Plainview knows this from the beginning, because when he says, "What are you going to use the money for, Eli?" and he goes, "For my church," and he goes, "Well, that's good." That's a good one.
I like how he starts off with a good, like, oh, that's good. That's a good one.
So
turning the sentence around.
I mean, I'm not sure what to say about the question of, like, what exactly you want to say happens to that character, whether it's something getting revealed or something changing. But the superficial change is evident, right? And you know, he mentions like radio and how he's getting into radio. So basically he's the one who we see make the transition most visibly and obviously from the end of one thing to the beginning of another thing, which is really what that what happens in that space that is elided. Something ends, the West ends, the frontier ends, and the industrial age begins, driven by oil. I mean, it's absolutely true that the rise of petroleum is the signal event, right? The ability to generate that much energy that cheaply is the sort of signal event of the rise of the industrial age, right?
It allows it to expand pretty much exponentially at that point.
I mean, oil is so powerful, we're still hugely reliant on it, right? Yeah. I mean, that's how good oil
there's
is.
Not, there's not that many 1900s technologies that we still use today.
And it's still, not only that, but it's central, and it's been central to our technology and to our global politics for the entire century. I mean, there are certain theories where the politics of oil is the defining feature, especially of post World War II 21st century politics, or 20th century politics.
We just watched Hombre and talked about Hombre last Wednesday, which is a Western movie set in made in the 60s, and you can't really disconnect it from the politics of its time, which was civil rights and racial dynamics, and this one. I remember going back to that NPR clip that I heard, they introduced it in regards to the Iraq war that was going on at the time. It had been raging for 4 years. Oil was at the center of global politics in 2007. It's kind of fallen off the map. Nobody talks about oil so much as, these days. It's now more, it's moved on to other things. But in 2007, everybody was still talking about oil.
Well, and that's why I think it found such a prominent voice and not only because it's just this frontier epic with a incredible performance and character at the center of it, someone who's like a mix of Captain Ahab and Elmer Gantry. Like he brings a kind of a religious fervor to the capitalist effort and that kind of denial of traditional moralism that was kind of what he saw as holding people back. And that's why he has resentment for Eli. But, oil as kind of a through line, I mean, it's interesting to see that within a 2007 movie adapted loosely off of a book from the 1920s that is based off of an actual oil baron of Edward Doheny. And you see these kind of through lines through the last 100 years. I mean, it is quite an encapsulation of a that's why this is such a kind of representation of an entire century. Yeah. Like what's going on in this very particular film.
That's why I will say that I kind of hate that people were reading it as like, well, the Iraq war is happening and that's about oil. Mm-hmm. That strikes me as like a very vulgar, like hot take kind of reading because...
Well, you could definitely see why it was on PTA's mind to want to do a story about the beginnings of the...
From what I know about Paul Thomas Anderson, I do know a little. I would never even guess what's in that guy's mind.
Yeah.
But I guess why I reject that kind of vulgar, like presentism kind of reading is because, like, the forces of sort of westward expansion, robber baron capitalism, and evangelical Christianity are, like, they're amongst the sort of top... Like, if you were going to think about the forces that shaped America, those would be three of the biggest. And so I feel like if this movie is of its time, I think it has less to do with oil, right? And more to do with the sort of general darkness of the kind of late Bush years, which we also see in No Country for Old Men, which we also see in Michael Clayton. Like that was a bleak time in America. And I think we see it reflected. I think we see that reflected in the cinema of that time. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't read this as a commentary on the Iraq War. I would not.
No. But I think the early 2000s, we're mired in... Well, first it was 9/11, which pretty much came down to our involvement in Middle East politics, which was all because of oil, which goes back for 30, 40 years, 50 years. And so when
heavily linked. We basically built the oil derricks in Saudi Arabia. It's like gave them that technology.
And so what you're seeing in the early 2000s at that point is really just it's still going. And it's still going because, and he wanted to go back to the very beginning of, you know, what was the explosion of all this that we're still seeing linger in all of our politics today.
But to me, like, No Country for Old Men is way more of a post 9/11 movie than this.
Because
No Country for Old Men is much more specifically about evil and what you do, like how you confront it.
Yeah, I don't.
Evil is a part of There Will Be Blood, but it's not really a movie about. It's not a movie about evil in the same way that No Country for Old Men is a movie
I don't
about
see any,
evil.
I don't see any bit of the Iraq situation in There Will Be Blood, but I could see why he'd want to look back.
But
I don't want to leave this
sort of religion point aside, because my point about Eli's transition, whatever you think about it, or whatever you think he ultimately was, the guy he is at the end is a person who has been completely subsumed at every level by capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at sort of the trajectory of evangelical Christianity in America, it'd be very hard to argue living in the age of like the Righteous Gemstones and prosperity gospel and the kind of very materialistic turn that evangelical Christianity has taken in America. It'd be very hard, I think, to argue with that if that is in fact part of what this movie is saying. I think it would be hard to argue with that upshot.
Yeah, that
capitalism is America's religion, and that everything else has been sort of buried in its wake. I mean, the idea of like people getting extremely rich and building mega churches and living lavish lifestyles off the world of Jesus Christ is so laughable. Right, given even just the most superficial reading of Christianity and the life of Christ, right? People just getting filthy rich off it is so hilarious.
Well, there is a link there in terms of going way back before this movie takes place with Calvinism, which was kind of the impetus of capitalism to start.
We live out of Catholicism, for instance.
You saw it come out of.
You're absolutely correct. Our modern Christianity is supercharged, insane Calvinism. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
And so it's the seeds were already there for Eli's character to want to expand his word. Oh, you're not asking for this $5,000. Because I think the implication is he asks for that $5,000. He gets that $5,000 and he skips town. And he tries out his radio thing because will reach more people, and it's holy because
he invests, he drinks, and maybe starts fucking dudes. We're not really sure
exactly,
but like the bottom line is he's fucking somebody, probably dudes.
probably
dudes. There's a slight implication that he might be fucking dudes, but he's fucking whoever he's fucking. He's two-fisting whiskey, and.
Yeah,
but what I'm saying is at the beginning of the movie, and by the beginning I really mean everything up till the end, I guess, there still is a percentage in importance that he seem poor, that he seem Christ-like, right? There still is that importance. And by the end of it, that is completely evaporated.
At the beginning, I saw that he could use that language.
But he also had used that appearance, right? He looks like shit. He dresses like shit. He's wearing bags or whatever.
There's little cues, though, in the very beginning where, because in this movie, this gets to a bigger point. In this movie, words and the people, speaking words holds a huge amount of power. You'll notice in the very first line that Daniel speaks is that it's this soliloquy to the people in that first town that have all the oil that's spilling out as a river. And he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, if I tell you and if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree." It's like the power of words. Like you don't just put it as like you might agree. You might agree with me if I say I'm an oil man.
He was doing Frank Lawrence.
Will agree.
He was doing words that work. Yeah. I don't think we're disagreeing though.
Eli does the same thing.
Yeah. Because what I'm talking about is his appearance and how he chooses to present.
I saw that he was also trying to use words. Because he's also a good wordsmith.
Oh, yeah.
And he uses the power of his words to convince all the people in town. He's trying to use these power of words to get one up on Daniel.
Oh, no, there's no doubt that he's a shit from beginning to end. But the specific way that he is and the specific way that he presents is very different at the end of the movie. The way he looks, the way he talks,
the way he acts. He almost sees himself
And to make even more of a fine point, he capitulates and says that what I believe is a sham, right?
Well, I think because Daniel finally gets it out of him. Tell me the truth about what you feel.
And
it's all a sham. It's always been a sham. You're actually not pulling the ghosts out of people's knuckles for their arthritis. If that's a sham, he wants him to say it because he's never said it up until now.
And the fact that he feels the need to change superficially as much as he does, much more than Daniel Plainview does, to me is just, like I said, I think that is...
I think he was always going for that.
Yeah, no,
he was always trying to get out of this damn town.
We're not disagreeing about that. You're talking about what you read as his actual character, and I'm talking about the way he presents to the world to serve his own ends. And the way that he presents to the world changes very dramatically.
As he shifts, as he's perceived, yeah, I think he shifts. I think that inner drive in him to really just kind of control other people and to get as far ahead as he can and to be as hypocritical as he needs to be is always within him.
Yeah, no, I think there is quite agreement on this front that there's a presentation, but that there's also an absolute acceptance of what he wants to do, and then he changes his presentation, he is mostly kind of acknowledging that and it might be because of that gap in time. The world has changed, where now the churches are kind of accepting this form of opulence that is kind of a reflection of the more of the era, rather, and that he is changing. I like that Mr. Thalen here is talking about how he presents himself in sort of a poor demeanor as among his people, but we're trying to say that he changes over time. But I really wanted to revisit this point about kind of what the West was and how we get to this point of choosing between these two, and how capitalism, as you say, kind of what was the word, kind of consumes all other forms and religion. Well, so, you know, during this time in the West, and, you know, what Plainview represents as the frontier, this idea of like manifest destiny, and that it's kind of it's an equal parts based off of the founding of America's in sort of an evangelical religious sort of way, an enlightenment sort of embodiment, but also a self-interest. This kind of drive of expansionism, self-interest, rugged individualism of the West. And Plainview is kind of a representation of that. And how do you get to a point where it's now between a traditional sort of Calvinist or Protestant kind of religion that helped foster these kinds of ideas of capitalism and mercantilism that kind of generated, and that they're kind of linked within history? How does there a separation? How does one end up consuming the other? Well, and I tapped into it just a little bit earlier about how one has tangible versus intangible elements, and that with Plainview, he offers a lot of things that are considered good and a development of progress. Like, here you have a community, Sunday's father, they have land they try and grow bread on. They pray for bread. They don't get bread. Like,
who doesn't?
Yeah, they pray for their bread. They pray for food. They pray
for
these things.
They're sorry they don't have it.
Yeah, exactly. But here comes Plainview, and then simply using the innovation, the drive, the ambition of this other side of the coin, of this other side of what drives kind of the progress forward, that kind of that is kind of creative destruction of the universe. It's like the destruction of environment for the creative forces of progress kind of thing. You have in him bringing tangible outcomes, like the community grows. He even chastises Eli's father. You know, Eli's he's like, you're not going to hit your daughter anymore. It's like kind of a fulfillment. Like, he's utilizing a sense of power to promote something that is beyond what is traditional morals or what was considered then. And so why does America then accept capitalism as kind of a force to reckon and sort of embrace over, say, the idea of religion in its past form? Is because it actually does like benefit most communities.
It delivers
something. At least it grows the community. It grows aspects of society. And you see that during that time. If you look at a graph, there's actually a really good uptick graph. It's like, what was the average income across the board? And it was at poverty level. And then after industrialization, it goes up. It goes way up for everybody. Yeah. And I'm not saying that there's not aspects to where people, where inequity finds itself in there, and that it's not that a lot of people do struggle still. I mean, it has not alleviated every form of problem, but it does actually give sort of this propulsion to the future, in that it generates something of wealth that can actually be attained. It benefits people, and so people force religion after, you know, when they pray for bread and it doesn't give them bread, they're going to go with the plain view.
I was going to say, to speak to that, I saw a little factoid of, I think around 1900, the poverty level was 95%.
Yes.
So literally almost everybody was, so it has exploded since then in terms of wealth and wealth for everybody. It really has gone around. But I will push back a little bit on the idea that, because he does come into this town with the promise that things are going to change. We're going to have schools. We're going to have, you know, I like how he picks up on the fact that Abel Sunday is ashamed of the fact that they don't have bread. It's like, remember where he's like, I'm sorry, we don't have any bread. Just, you know, corn won't grow around here. I'm sorry. As Daniel's walking away, he's apologizing profusely over the fact that they don't have bread. He picks up on that, because I don't think he cares about bread one way or another.
And think about now, think about how much more you could sell goat milk for at Whole Foods now than you sell bread.
Exactly. I know.
And way more. Exactly.
But Daniel picks up on that, and he tells the town that I think that, you know, having no bread is an abomination, and it's a disgrace against God or something like that, where it's like he knows that Abel finds
He's
ashamed by that. And so he tells the town that you should be ashamed for not having bread, and I'm going to bring you bread through irrigation.
Oh, I'm not.
But also notice that by the end of it, there's no bread in that town. I don't see any irrigation. I don't see any change in that.
Where's
regard.
The bread?
Well, you do see you do see a community thriving and build, and then you do see the elements that on the horizon there is going to be development.
But all you have to do is, have you ever been through this small town called Taft?
Oh yeah,
It's what this is based on. How thriving is that town?
Well, I mean, they are still in a desert.
It's a shithole.
Well, I mean, there's a few turns. I mean, it's funny that I'm going to be taking this position right here, given my broader political commitments. Yeah. But I mean, there are a few turns of the screw between now and then, right? I mean, we know the world that this California gives rise to because we live in it, right?
Yeah,
right. Like, and yes, I mean, there have been, you know. I mean, you know, at mid-century, who knows? Here's a little trivia question. In America, in the middle of the century, 1950, what was the richest city in America?
Detroit?
Absolutely Detroit. Ding, yeah. Ding, ding, yeah. Right? So, I mean, wheel keeps turning, right? But, like, I mean,
I would say that Daniel Plainview does manage to keep most of the wealth to himself. He promises a great deal.
Oh,
but he does. He knows that he doesn't have to deliver once he promises.
I'm not. So there's. I think there's a difference between what Daniel Plainview represents and then Daniel Plainview as the character, because Plainview is very much, because of that misanthropy, because of his sort of inhuman denial of other people. I don't think he very much has a desire to share. and that doesn't necessarily negate the kind of the system or the process, but it does sort of show that there are faults in that.
Well, I mean to you know, put even more sort of economic, cultural, historical, political perspective on this. I mean, everything that Kyle said and everything that this movie is showing us is completely intelligible through the views of someone like Marx, right? If we're going to talk about philosophy, we've already mentioned Nietzsche,
yeah.
Right? Like, the idea that capitalism would sort of inevitably rise and bring with it all this progress and be something that sort of no force could really oppose as it rose is 100% out of Marx, right? It's not It's not like, and I agree with you, part of the reason why is because it renders the old ways sort of unintelligible to the point of being ridiculous. I mean, we do have an example near the end of the movie of someone who seems to have true religious faith, which is what's his name? The crazy old guy that he needs to get the lease from.
Bandy. Yeah.
Bandy seems to be 100% religiously motivated. There's no sign at any point that his motivation is anything other than purely religious. In stark contrast to Eli, right, who is...
Does he even actually want his money at the end? I think he doesn't even want...
He
doesn't even talk dollars and cents. He just wants him to get baptized. He wants to save his immortal soul, which is a very thoughtful thing to do for another person, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And
especially
and
when you know they just murdered somebody.
And he like, I mean, I did, you know, I don't know who listens to this. I don't want to, you know, whatever. I don't care if I offend people, actually. People who are truly religious in that way, like true believers, are unintelligible to most of us. And I don't mean that even as an insult. It's just their way is not, like someone who says, like, I don't care about any of that. But I do believe that it is incumbent upon me as a Christian to save you from an eternity of damnation.
See, actually,
I mean, that's so wild to us. Like,
I've
whatever,
heard a great summation of that is, like, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses. They go from door to door, and they believe that if you don't join them, you're going to hell.
And even if you do join them, you might still go to hell.
But do they really believe that? Because if they really believe that, wouldn't they never leave your doorstop? Because, oh my God, you realize how bad this is. They would, if it is what they say it is, they would never give up on getting you to believe.
I don't know if you realize
how bad this decision is.
I don't know if I agree with that or not, but I do think that, like someone like Eli, whatever we think about him, we can at least understand him, right? Mm-hmm. His way of being in the world, which is compromised, which is 100% compromised, is very intelligible to us. Whereas someone like Bandy is totally foreign.
Okay, because so we get that Eli is really just using the language to control other people.
I could be Eli. I could absolutely be Eli.
Yeah. Yes.
I cannot imagine being Bandy. I cannot imagine being him.
I think it takes a certain simpleton view of everything, and then you could be Bandy. But I just don't even have access.
My point is I don't even have access to that.
And neither do I. But I think that if I was a little more dumb and I was just – and I thought of everything in black and white, I could see how I might be Bandy. But I wouldn't recognize myself anymore.
I'm such a dyed-in-the-wool atheist. I don't think all religious people are dumb.
No.
Well, I mean,
I think to be a believer at that level in 2020 in America or in 2024 when this gets released.
See, that's where it comes up with, like, in the modern day.
It's just very hard for me. Whereas to be like sort of like even if you take. Like whatever sort of interpretation you take of the Eli character, I think I take a bit more sympathetic interpretation than yours. I think at the beginning he might have sort of believed, right? He might have had some kernel of real faith,
but he also recognized that he had power over others.
But I'm just saying, I can imagine being a guy who's in that position, who kind of believes, who finds himself down the road, who kind of gets a taste of the good life and keeps on wanting more. Like, I can completely get to that point.
Mm-hmm. I can see that, but I don't think Eli's that.
Well,
I can see somebody who's a little bit more believing in his own religion. I don't feel that. I think Eli sees it as it's a vehicle that he controls better than others, and it's probably why his brother left.
In fact, because
he sees that Eli has got this town by the nuts.
I would even go farther. I think that Eli is the most accessible character, because I think, and this goes back to Kyle's first point, I think Plainview is very inaccessible because his level of ambition. Mm-hmm. There's a great line from one of the William Gibson books. I forget which one, but it basically goes like, you know, she looked into the eyes, this person's eyes, and she realized that the extremely rich were not even remotely human. Like, people at that level of ambition are not like you and I.
No, there's people like that
and professional athletes. Those people are just not wired like you and me, because it requires a level of obsession and dedication that the vast, vast majority of us just cannot muster.
No.
And so, just to come back to Eli, like, whatever you think about him, being sort of a self-serving shithead who kind of plays the hand that he's gotten... uses his sort of gift of doing that kind of wild kind of evangelical bullshit to prop up his existence, to get a little money and get away. Like, all of that is like just totally normal human shit.
Yeah,
which
all
is in stark is contrast to Plainview, right?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, all it takes is being the smartest person in Little Boston, and
yeah.
I don't see many smart people there.
No, I wanted to talk on a couple things on this. One on Mr. Thalen's view of Bandy being someone who's inaccessible and Dano's Eli Sunday being someone who is accessible. There's a thing that I always try and articulate with people who are faithful, people who are religious, because I am not. I try and urge them that true faith comes through kind of a questioning and a skepticism. Bandy's one of those people who doesn't. And so when you kind of put yourself in that kind of that box, it comes off as simple minded. So he is a simple minded character.
But I'm gonna put you on Front Street a little bit. Feel free to edit this if you if you want to. Like, insofar as you have history with Christian religion, it is Catholicism.
Yeah.
Catholicism, say what you will for it, is a pro-intellectual strand of Christianity.
Yes, in a lot of ways.
Which is why, like, the Supreme Court has 6 Republican, you know, type nominees, and they're all Catholic, right? It's not surprising
that's relatively recent.
And I'm not the first person to make this point. I'm not sure. I'm not sure who the first Catholic was. But I'm saying that, like, it's not surprising that the people from the right wing, who they can at least make a credible case, are smart enough and have the credentials to be on the Supreme Court, are all Catholics.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not surprising that evangelical right wing Christians who got their law degrees from, like, Liberty have not been making that cut. So, I mean, I agree with you. There are, and that's why I sort of push back a little bit on the idea of people of faith. I'm an atheist. But
I'm atheist
all around. But I do think that, like, you know, there's a wide range of religious people, and there are a wide range of religious traditions, and some of them are more anti-intellectual than others. And I would say that this strain of American Protestantism,
is not.
I mean, you see it, right? I mean, Eli is a proto. Jim Baker, you know, he's a proto Righteous Gemstones guy. He's out there banishing out demons by shouting or I've learned I can whisper now. Like, I mean, shit is straight out of American evangelical Protestantism. No. I'll tell you that most of the rest of the world would look at that. You know, certainly the Catholic world would look at that and be like, that's fucked up. I don't know what the fuck
that is.
It's
fucked up America.
Like, we just stopped doing masses in Latin like 100 years ago. So fuck that.
One thing that comes to mind from talking about these people who are all religious, you know, uniformly religious, all these people at Little Boston, definitely what comes to mind and what was eye-opening to me was watching The Witch. And I know you've probably seen that, Kyle.
Yes, I have.
That movie was eye-opening in how it showed these, I'm guessing these were like 17th century Americans.
Every thought
that they had was biblical, was religious, was about God or the devil. Every single thought. There wasn't a conversation in that movie that didn't involve that.
Well, Ben, my interpretation of The Witch really is that if the atmospheric tone that's being created is like you stepping into whether their paranoid, folksy biblical fantasies are a reality in a horror form. Like, that's why it feels that way.
But I also get the feeling that even if the horror aspect of it doesn't come out, every conversation they have will still be about God or the devil.
Yeah.
God, the devil, Bible, God, devil, Bible will be the theme of every sentence that comes out of your mouth.
But that sort of goes to why the focus on Christianity and There Will Be Blood is certainly the deepest and the longest standing one in the American vein, right? Because America was the place that Europe sent all its fucking religious lunatics.
I get the sense that Eli Sunday, for instance, he's a part of this same thread.
Of course.
Maybe they have 5 or 6 conversations a day that aren't about explicitly about religion, but the rest of them are definitely about religion. Everybody in that family, the whole Sunday family, they're a family of Sundays. They're definitely religious. And so I get the feeling that, you know, Eli, he's really kind of just born out of that, and he is a master of
it. But I think that's actually a great way to frame, like, the kind of big picture of this movie, because I think part of what this movie is asking, and this is, like I say, a very relevant question in America to this day, is what happens when you take the sort of people that you see in the Vavitch and you push them through to, like, something of what they believe remains, like the sort of I don't even know what to call it, the style of their belief or the kind of something about it,
embellished vigor.
Yeah, something about it survives, but the core of it has been completely hollowed out by capitalism and by
the dollar. Wasn't hollowed out then.
But
gets hollowed out from that time to now.
But there's still something about it nevertheless persists, right? Yeah. And that's what we're living with today.
Yeah.
That is a big strain of American Protestantism, right?
And
church culture. That's what it becomes.
Yeah.
I can probably almost relate to religion better. The religion that the Vavitch, as you put it, brings up, or the religion that Eli Sunday lives in, I can relate to that better than I can relate to, what's his face?
I think you can relate to it.
Guy.
I think you can relate to both of those because they were still not hollowed out attempts to understand the world that was around them, and so there was something within them that was not intellectual, but of an experiential quality to understand my relationship in this world. And they were trying to explain to themselves. They were trying to explain how the world operates, and unfortunately. For them, like, the world progressed beyond this, and now 100%. And now they can't necessarily explain the world in those sort of ways, but they that tethering to that faith that has kind of kept going to today it's almost a survivalist dependency on something that is antiquated and that they hold on to based off of. I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's kind of a fearful paranoia that they don't know how the modern world necessarily operates.
Well, yeah, and you can also in that way see Plainview as a stand-in for natural science and technology, right? Because, like, what happens? This is a great way to put it. Like, what happens when the questions that it was meant to answer have been answered? Like, ancient pagan religions, right? They make all the sense in the world. If you've lived through an earthquake, it feels like the anger of the gods, and only like your understanding of like seismic technology tells you otherwise, right? Same with all natural phenomenon, right? So believing that the sun was a god or there's a rain god or whatever makes all the fucking sense in the world in a society where in a prehistoric time, right? Or in an early historic time, or even in the time of the pilgrims, right, where they're trying to understand things that they can't understand. Yeah. But as natural science becomes applied science, right, and we become able to drill down into the ground and take the remains of dinosaurs, pump them up to into the sky, right, and power the internal combustion engine, like quaint theories about, fucking fairies or angels just seem hard to sustain, right, because they no longer are required. No. And like you say, like you said earlier, they no longer pay the bills, right? You know, the oil puts money on the table. What gets us bread? Fucking oil gets us bread. And so, but these things continue on, right? And what happens when they continue on?
We definitely saw religion get chipped away, like from the 17th century on, really. Galileo was in, 1600s, right?
It was Copernicus and Galileo, I want to say. Late 16th, really early 17th, I want to say.
It was around
and before
that time.
Him, it was, I know, Tycho Brahe and Kepler. It was these, they really started chipping away at what religion is explaining. And by the time we get to today, religion is really not explaining anything anymore. There's nothing really that a religion can explain.
Well, yeah, not in this.
Science hasn't really given the real answer.
Yeah, not in this tangible quality. That's why I keep returning to it. It's like, that amazingly shot oil derrick sequence, which is a thrilling sequence. But I mean, really, it culminates to a shot of him sitting, watching the oil coming from the ground. That is that is a shot of how progress, technology, science is powering through the future. Yeah. I mean, that shot alone shows you what is now Plainview's religion, in a sense, and how he knows how to use the words like Eli Sunday does with his piety and pious people. But he, Plainview is utilizing religious fervor, and this is what's kind of manipulative and a bit monstrous about the character, and sort of a representation of the balancing act of science, technology, capitalism, all of this, all these tenets that are moving the world forward. He is using kind of that use of language, that religious language. You will believe I am an oil man. All these things that we've talked about, he is using the religious fervor of the past with his connection to a religion of the future, which is business, which is self-interest, which is all of these things that he represents. And I mean, you have to kind of, you know, that's why I find him of quite an admirable character, while also being, you know, quite monstrous. But his monstrous qualities, I don't think, were fashioned by capitalism per se. I think capitalism allowed a monster to sort of find his way into the system.
I think we discussed this a little bit on Wednesday, kind of pre-discussion for this movie, is that, yeah, capitalism isn't inherently evil like this, or it isn't inherently monstrous or without, you know, caring. But it does allow that type of person to thrive. He thrives in a way.
Well, especially because we've commented, about how in the beginning he's an example of a man of the frontier that would go out there. These kind of weirdos, these self-interested, manifest destiny-driven people, that they are not like us, and it takes a lot of people like
you wouldn't do what this guy did.
Oh no,
right?
I wouldn't do any single thing that he did in this film, yeah. And that's why I find him quite astonishing of a character, and a representation form of like what the system can allow and who can propel the future forward in this way. But I also, you know, it also is a striking, you know, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson has called this not only his Western, but is also his horror film, because there's something horrifying about what he ends up becoming in his misanthropy and his apathy and his isolation. And again, I think he's the same person in the beginning as he is in end. I think he always wanted to be alone, but he was driven by an addiction to wealth and not wealth to attain. I mean, the process, I think he's addicted to the process of attainment. And so right. it's,
but
it's,
you'd have to be to
yeah,
be him.
You would,
right.
Yeah.
You'd have to be.
And the thing
be.
Is, and he, it's his early successes that gets him to the point where he can be and call himself an oil man and have his viable wells that propel him to do more. By the time he gets to Little Boston and he's buying everybody out, you realize the only people who can do this are people who have a shit ton of money already and can buy everybody out really quick and then take what's underneath them. And if it's not going to be him, it's going to be somebody just like him.
Well, but that's why the mountain for him to climb is not to outsmart those people, right? I mean, like...
I think that's where the indictment of capitalism comes in, is that it will always be just another person like him, because that is, at the beginning, that is the only type of person who has the means to make it work. None of these people can actually get oil out of the ground.
No.
And none of these people can withstand that person who can come in and can buy it out from the one person. All it takes is one person to sell their land to a guy like Daniel. Remember, in that very first town he goes to, he bypasses the whole crazy town and says, nope, I don't want it. I wouldn't take it if you gave it to me as a gift. But then he goes to somebody who lives just north of the town, buys his place, and he will now get all the oil underneath there.
Because of he drinks their milkshake.
That's right.
Because he drinks their milkshake. And it does set it up that it is inevitable that capitalism will yield to the worst person, because the worst types have the means to do it. And they have the ability and they will do it.
Well, I mean, there's truth to that.
I say that as a fan of capitalism.
No. It's a truth to that. But I also think it takes a, you know, it, you know, Plainview clearly wasn't Mr. Wealthy at the beginning of this film. Like he's in a silver mine.
And more importantly, I think in some ways, he's not Mr. Happy at the end.
Well,
of
no, and he's not.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, this is a tragic movie.
Yes,
this
it is
not,
very
this
tragic.
This is not like. Like we were talking about the role that religion still plays. Well, one of the roles that religion plays is that a lot of successful people, unlike Daniel Plainview, want to also think that they're good,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And they want to think that their goodness has led to their success. Their goodness in a Christian sense, not in a Nietzschean sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why you bringing up Nietzsche is correct. Plainview is good in a Nietzschean sense, right? Yes. Which is to say that he embodies, you know, what he is perfectly and pursues it perfectly. And is not deterred from it. He is exactly what he appears to be.
God is dead. He's cast out all the traditional means. Yeah,
but he is not good, and he does not think of himself as good. He's not Dale Carnegie, right? No. He's not someone who's out there, sort of, or Ayn Rand, for that matter. Like he has no message that like what he's doing is good, even on the social political level, right?
Or Doheny, who this is kind of based on, he was a philanthropist, and
well, they all end up philanthropists.
They all end up that way.
You got to spend your money somehow.
But I mean, like, but he is not a political character, right? He does not present as having any sort of an ideology. He never expresses a political view. In fact, this is telling, because this is just how much a movie about capitalism that this is. The politicians are never talked about.
No.
Right? So this is a movie about...
It's almost kind of assumed that capitalists can do it.
Yeah, where
they like.
Where does... This is a movie that is honest in that way about where the power really lies. Nobody ever talks about a politician in this movie.
Yeah.
There's no... The people who have power are Standard Oil, and that's who he's trying to defeat.
And
right? His big enemy is... The person that he's trying to beat are not the townspeople who he snows right away and very easily. It's Standard Oil, right? That's why the sort of heroic moment for him is building the pipeline.
Yes, because he can bypass them. He bypassed the trains.
And not only that, like in the very first scene of them arriving to this town, he's explaining to HW why it's important to bypass Standard, you know, where they're going, how they're going to build a pipeline to Port Hueneme, or
I mean, at the end of the day,
he lays it out at the very beginning.
He was one of the pioneers of something that people talk about to this day, right? Which is something called vertical integration.
Yeah, exactly.
Vertical integration,
right? Because if you can't move the shit, like the Standard Oil guy says to him early, if you can't move it, it's worth nothing to you.
Yeah, you're just sitting on a ton of oil that you can't move.
Yeah.
Let's take it off your hands. That scene does also show how he was desperate to pass this along to somebody, to share this with somebody. And I don't think we've really gotten into the character of Daniel, of why he is the way he is. He is a lonely man who can't trust people.
No,
he can only trust blood, which is why he keeps trying to force blood into his life. He adopts a child.
He was forged on the mean streets of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin.
I mean, I think the title "There Will Be Blood" fits in many ways, but one of them is that he is trying to keep forcing this idea of family into his own life.
Yes,
so that he can share something with somebody without worry about, is this person trying to weasel their way into my life?
Yeah,
he can't trust anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I guess HW is like that. It's like athletes that marry their high school girlfriend, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, before they ever got famous. That's the only one they can trust.
Yeah, I mean, but I will come back to you, maybe for no reason at all. I mean, he does have real affection. I mean,
he does. I do believe
now
that.
I think that's the thing. Like, he does have real affection for...
And even to the end...
HW, even though he denies it.
Even at the end, because he's so hurt by him.
Yes.
I think at a fundamental level, he's just so, like, that end sequence is all about that he is just so hurt by this kid's totally normal decision to be like, I want to go do my own thing. I mean, that's basically what he says. Like, I want to go do my own thing. I don't want to do your thing.
Yeah.
Which is like a totally normal thing for a kid to do, right? Be like, I've been in your shadow long enough, Dad.
And it's really kind of
do my own thing.
Yeah,
it's the conflict that every father has with their son about eventually their son wants to move on. Well, unless they're Donald Trump Jr. But but I mean,
people aren't even going to know who that is when this airs. We have a short memory here. We have a short memory here.
He's a nobody now.
I feel that with my own dad, where he wants me to follow in his footsteps a bit. But I want to forge out and, you know, have my own.
Do you think DJ life. Maybe DJ TJ goes to Trump Steaks, tries to bring that brand back? You know, just like make Dad happy. No, I mean,
well,
Well, I mean, because Legacy comes
in competition with Ivanka.
I mean, Legacy comes into play here. That's why there's this through line of blood in creation, blood in oil, blood in relation. And I mean, that's why he's so, you know, quick to sort of humor the idea of this half brother. And, you know, when he finds out that he has lied to him, that his actual half brother is dead. I mean, and it becomes this murderous outburst, and it's because he's so betrayed.
It's an immediate change. You see it on the beach, where he asks about this, what, Point Lamoc or whatever, this house and
the peach tree dance or whatever.
And he recognizes the guy that the guy doesn't recognize it.
Well, this also sounds like bullshit, right? There are no peaches in Wisconsin. I've spent a lot of time in Wisconsin. They were fucking apples.
Maybe they were being ironic.
I read a few pages of the script. The script goes into a lot more detail of, it's actually his man Fletcher who starts planting seeds in his head of, are you sure this guy is really your half brother? And maybe, you know, ask him about, I'll look into so-and-so about, you know, Point Lamoc or whatever that thing was. I can't even remember.
And it's funny because that gets boiled down to just one line, right? Which is that, you're not taking him with you, are you?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Which is like a throwaway line.
Yeah, exactly. The original script had a lot more in there of Fletcher, because Fletcher does get pushed aside without good reason, because Fletcher should be the guy that Daniel trusts. Fletcher was there by Daniel's side from the very beginning when Paul Dano's character first comes through. Paul, actually, right? His name was Paul.
Yes, yeah.
When he comes through and, you know, sells him the location, Fletcher really should have been that guy that Daniel trusted, because he was worthy of his trust. I mean, when the well glows, Fletcher is the one who runs to HW and gets him off the...
Siren Hens is great in it as that... because he's kind of a representation of like that there can be a bit of humanism and integrity in this endeavor and have a care. I mean, he's the one who asks. He's like, is HW okay? And he goes, no, he's not. But he's
right.
Staring at that oil derrick.
Yeah, but he's in.
Yeah, and as they're staring at the oil, he's like, he tells Siren Hines, he tells him, like, what are you so unhappy about? there's an ocean of oil under our feet, and only I can get to it. He's like...
But like,
he's worried about your kid, you asshole. And yeah, happy because you have an ocean of oil on your feet, even though your kid just had a huge accident.
And he's a normal person, right? I mean, he's a normal person every other person, which is to say he doesn't have this kind of single-minded ambition.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And to do that would be, like I said, I mean, like, these people are, I mean, they're psychotic, right? I mean, super ambitious, super wealthy people are crazy.
This is where Daniel's fault lies, I think, is that he is a miserable, awful person because he can't trust anyone. Well, he hates other people because he sees the worst in them. He can't trust them, but he has somebody right next to him that is a good person that he can trust, but he doesn't.
But it's so funny.
That's his huge fault.
But it's so funny, right? Because I feel like there's at least one reading of this, though, that, I mean, this is just such an old story. It's kind of cliched, but you hear people who start things all the time say, like, well, I started doing the one thing. Now it's coding, right? I started, I could just code all day, and I like coding. Then I got rich, and then I had to become an administrator. But it could happen with anyone. It happens with cooks, like chefs and bakers and whoever. I started doing the one thing that I like to do, which was to be in the kitchen cooking, and now I run this big empire, and I sit at a desk and answer emails and do meetings. Right. So, I mean, in some ways, his story is a bit cliched, right? I mean, I get the sense that at the end of the movie, he's miserable because, like I said earlier, he was right. He wants to be out there doing shit, and he's not out there doing shit anymore.
No. Well, he's
I do believe that these people want to
be doing shit with people, though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's I agree with you. That's part of the issue. Right. But like, I do think it is true that people who get successful at this level, they do actually generally love to the point of obsession the very specific process-oriented things that got them there.
Yes.
Like, Jeff Bezos is really obsessed with...
What are some good examples?
Yeah, Jeff Bezos is completely obsessed with...
What are some good examples of successful people who are doing it right in our minds? Like, I think Bill Gates.
I don't think...
Or even Warren Buffett.
I like I said, I have no access to... I have no access to those people's moral qualities, and I don't generally have thoughts.
Well, I just watched an interview with Bill Gates. He seems like a normal person.
I mean, Bill
Gates seems like somebody you could talk to.
Bill Gates was the villain of, you know, yesteryear.
Yeah, he was the villain of yesteryear. But I mean, you again, I can't lead into a statement of their morals, but I can assume that there's a lot of PR that goes into a lot of good moral decision making with a lot of these higher ups. Like, I think it's planned out a lot of ways.
But my point was a different one, which is that I think the only thing that I think is transparent about them is that there are aspects of what they do. And by what they do, I don't mean at some high level abstraction. I mean the day-to-day, like the work that got them there, that they're obsessed with and that brings them joy and pleasure in and of itself.
Yeah, it's kind of an Aristotelian view of happiness. It's like doing the things that you love to do.
Or
the coding things.
The coding thing with Bezos. Like, Bezos is clearly obsessed with and interested in, like, the behavior and functioning logistics of large organisms and logistics. Yes, he clearly finds he clearly finds, like, solving those problems, like, very satisfying. It is,
but I see somebody like
richest man.
But I see something like Bill Gates, who was a nerd coder. He's the coder that you were describing. You know, at this point it's 40 something years ago, the late 70s, where he was, you know, at the very basic level, putting ones and zeros together to make an operating system. But at a certain point in the late 90s or early 2000s, he switched gears completely, you know, focuses energy on eliminating diseases in areas where diseases were taking down the most people. So his prime goal just became to try to save as many lives as possible.
And he seems to have taken that very well. I do think that Gates is probably, I don't know. I mean, this is a rabbit hole. Like I said, I don't know about people's moral character because I can't read their minds. But I do think that he has taken whatever he was good at in one area and transferred it to another area. I don't want to say good at, because I'm not sure actually how successful he is, but or how successful his foundation is. That's controversial. But he certainly finds solving the particular problems he has put before himself interesting.
Yeah, it's a matter of focusing people's guidance and effort, and if they lose that, they sort of become, I mean, that's the tragedy of Plainview. Is if he can't find a different focus, if he can't find another problem to solve, another avenue to venture, he becomes an isolated, miserable entity.
Well, and also their reflection.
But he wanted to become, like, an isolated miserable.
Well, I think he does want to become that, but he doesn't realize how actually sad it is. He thinks that other people are hell. He hates them. He despises them. He's distrustful. And then once he really does find himself at the pinnacle of being alone with his son, basically, and he interprets that with his son, HW, saying, I want to go start my own thing. I don't want to be I want you to be my father, not my boss.
Yeah.
And he decides that is basically a betrayal, a denial of, like, this kind of relationship, the only kind of relationship that he could fathom or connect with and understand in his life, because that's how psychotic and focused he is about it.
That's why it is
a tragic story. That's why that ending is kind of, it's cathartic in a way to see the showdown of capitalism versus religion, and to have want to be punching Eli Sunday in the face and watching him get pummeled with a bowling pin is pretty cathartic in this kind of epic operatic showdown in American cinema, and its symbolism is phenomenal. It's on a large scale degree of drama that is pretty much not matched by a lot of other films. I mean, here's Paul Thomas Anderson kind of elating the Citizen Kaneisms of it to a greater degree of sort of this showdown between ideology and progress and religion. It's pretty phenomenal, but really at the core of it, that sort of outcome, like, that was the last bit of vigor that he had, a focused drive, was Eli Sunday, because they throughout the entire time They are toe-to-toe. They are representations of similar attitudes and ways about getting means. And they see through each other. But I also think Plainview would have admired Eli Sunday if he wasn't such a pain in the ass to him. And because he is a pain in the ass, that's his last focus. When he says, "I'm finished," he's finished. He has no other drive and focus. He's going to sit. He'll probably just sit there in that puddle of blood and die. That's pretty much the only thing he has left to do.
There was a great moment in a Charlie Rose interview with Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson, where he asks Daniel Day-Lewis, "Like, do you think Daniel has a certain respect for Eli Sunday?" And Daniel Day-Lewis kind of still, you can tell he's still relating to the character of Daniel. He says, "Well, I think he sees his version of, you know, kind of manipulating others and controlling others as a more noble pursuit than Eli's, which is just, you know, using religion for it." And Charlie Rose at that point, he goes, "Like, have you not fully left your character?" Like, because it had come up previously that it sometimes takes 2 or 3 months for him to leave his character, where it's like he wanted to even hold on to it. Like, no, Daniel's better than Eli. I don't know if he fully respects Eli, because he sees Eli as using
I didn't say he does. I said he would have if he weren't such a repulsive figure of like a reflection of him.
I think he would see anybody who uses religion to control others as being a charlatan.
That's true.
And the only proper pursuit of using others is for capitalism.
Yeah.
That's respectable. But religion is just taking advantage of idiots.
I mean, do we think he really cares what's respectable? I mean,
I don't see him as a person with
political views, or for that matter, real moral views. Yeah, he does have a certain kind of existential hatred.
He doesn't need to pay attention to morals. But that's something for the plebeians.
Maybe so. I don't know. But like he does have a kind of very specific allergic reaction to Eli, right? Which is that he hates the kind of
he hates
that particular brand of.
I mean, you see it. He'll even say, like, "Get me out of here," when he's in that other great scene where he's slapping him around. He sees him
as a kind of snake oil salesman.
Yeah. Maybe, even Henry asks him, like, "Well, what happened? Where's HW's mother?" He's like, "I don't like to talk about my past." He doesn't want to talk about the shit with anybody.
Yeah.
And you don't have the right to ask him. Nobody has the right to ask him. And it's because he's attained such a heights, basically, of capitalism, that he's reached a point where he doesn't have to address anybody. And that's what he wants.
I don't know if that's why he's not going to talk about it, right? I mean,
well, he doesn't want to talk about it, definitely.
But like,
and he's reached a pinnacle of life where he doesn't have to. I mean, nobody can question him. He reminds me a bit of Trump in that regard. Nobody can ask Trump why do you do what you do. Mm-hmm. He can just leave the room if he wants to.
But Trump can get through his entire life without being asked. That's funny. He doesn't really remind me of Trump at all. I mean, Trump is a moron, right?
Plainview reminds me of him in that if he wants a certain thing away, if he doesn't want to address his past, he will not address it.
Yeah, but he doesn't address it to anybody. Trump is a person of endless grievance. Like, he's always relitigating.
Well, there's that.
Like,
I'm talking about just trying to mold your reality.
The famous tweet, right, about Graydon Carter, how his Oscar party sucks now. I mean, that's like, Trump has sent out a million tweets like that. Like, he's a person who carries around, he bitches about everybody, but
he also tries to mold his reality, and Daniel is doing that throughout the whole movie. He wants to mold his reality, he doesn't want to answer certain things, but Trump has failed. But that's fine. Those are two different outcomes, but they have the same mindset of wanting to control what could be asked of them.
I mean,
control of who has the voice in the room.
I don't want to get too into the weeds.
I really just want to address it real quick before we move on to a different. I think Trump actually is more of an Eli Sunday than he is a Daniel Plainview.
I think that's right.
Daniel Plainview is actually intelligent. He forges a path forward based off of his own resilience, his own ambition, his own sense of thriving. He depends on nobody. He uses people. Sure, these are monstrous qualities that he manipulates and goes through the film for sure. But it's Eli Sunday who uses what he is again attainable to him and what's at his expendability to manipulate his environment and fails to do so in a lot of regard. He thinks he has a upper hand in one way. You know, when he has, I mean, that entire baptism sequence, Eli thinks he has the upper hand in the sequence, and even though he does break and show some true emotional connection to his son and some real regret, basically he comes out of that smiling because he won over everybody. He went through the torture of that sequence and has, it's like, I don't have to do that again. I just did
by the end of it, he's going, give it to me, Lord. Give it to me. Oh, there's your Lord. Yeah. Oh, there it is.
Well, and so for this Trump illusion, I think Trump, because he was given a lot of his opportunities, he fashioned a lot of his opportunities based off of that, what was at his expendability and what was in his vicinity of action. And he's constantly failed throughout his entire life. Like he's propped up his brand, which is his name, and his. And I think Eli Sunday did the same thing. He propped up himself as kind of a brand of the church.
I mean, if you wanted to draw a sort of through line from Plainview to Trump, I think it would basically say that, well, both of them, they both reflect in very different ways, like the kinds of things that would make you successful at different stages of history and capitalism, right? Because whatever you want to say about Plainview, as Kyle has pointed out, I mean, he made a real material impact on the world. He went and, you know, into the middle of nowhere and extracted the most useful resource and transformed, you know, played a role in transforming the face of the earth.
And he went from resource to resource to resource, whatever he needed.
Whereas Trump is an example of how we, like, I'm not the first person to make this point, but, like, our culture is so sort of obsessed with celebrity, and Trump was so obsessed with becoming a celebrity, that Trump was so good at cultivating celebrity and pursuing celebrity that he became president by accident.
Yes, yeah.
Like, he didn't actually want to become president.
I don't think he did, yeah.
He just, literally happened by accident, which
I describe him as a tuning fork that has just the right pitch.
Yes, absolutely. But that is like, so they're both sort of men of their moment who have created for themselves, like, I don't want to call it a persona, but, like, they have lived their life in such a way as to maximize the amount of success they could have in their moment, but the way that they do it is vastly different, and it's a reflection of what is different about now and sort of late capitalism, where, like, what Trump has is a kind of currency versus, you know, the more purely materialist success of Daniel
Plainview. Let me try to tie all three together then.
Sure.
Because I did notice this early on, in that a big theme of the movie is that people control others with words. And, like, you know, that very first thing is, if I tell you I'm an oil man, you will believe me. But it's also in other ways in how they interrupt each other or how they don't answer each other's questions. It happens immediately when you see Daniel and Paul come together. Paul comes in. It's like, I know of a place. I just want $1,000. And Daniel says, okay, well, where are you from? It's like, well, that would be what I'm trying to sell you. He's not going to answer his questions. There's moments where Daniel's about to say something and Paul cuts him off, and you don't see him get cut off by anybody but Paul in that very first scene and by Eli later on.
But
interrupting other people is their way of, and controlling the dialogue of what's being discussed is very important to all three of those, well, really to Daniel and Eli.
But
and they go back and forth with their power by their ability to interrupt each other.
It's so funny, though, that you bring up that scene, because it's such a small moment, but it's obviously very important. And I think it's worth noting that Paul is one of the few people who sort of sees immediately through Daniel Plainview, has a very clear objective,
and achieves
his objective, right? He wants to get some money, because he's getting the hell out of town, and he just wants to get some cash and go.
The negotiating tactic was perfect. Remember, yeah. He asked him, like, I want $1,000. And he counters with $500. And then the guy, he says, 600. Or he actually, no, he starts with $500 and he immediately just goes up to 600 when Daniel tries to go back and forth with him. He negotiates with him perfectly, goes toe to toe with Daniel right off the bat. It is a great scene. I love that one. It really sets him
up. He's the promised son, you know.
Paul was
the promised son, not Eli. Well, and you know, just a real tidbit before I let Ben continue the conversation, but I just want everyone to know Paul Dano was not supposed to play Eli Sunday. He was only hired as Paul, and he when the other actor dropped out because of supposed intimidation from Daniel Day-Lewis, a lot of people there's some discrepancies from the stories, but Paul Dano stepped up to play Eli. He had 4 days to prep for this role, just to put that into perspective.
It's so amazing to me. I just want to linger on this for a moment. That he did not get nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
I know. I was right in his corner for it.
I can't believe it because I didn't know that fact. But like, he goes toe to toe with probably the greatest screen actor of all time.
Yeah.
Right. And
gets under his skin.
And the scenes that they have together, the end scene, the baptism scene, the scene in the oil.
The oil mud, yeah.
They are the best scenes in the movie. They are the most memorable scenes in the movie.
That opening scene where Daniel reaches out to shake his hand and he brings out his left hand so that he can kind of grasp both hands in a kind of a prayer circle.
Yeah.
And it's like it was a great little just subversion of, oh, you want this? I'm going to give you this instead.
Yeah. I think that performance is tremendous.
Exceptional.
And I mean,
it was so
like I said,
insidious too.
It's hard, right? It's hard to stand next to Daniel Day-Lewis in a less good movie, but with an equally spectacular or almost equally spectacular performance. Maybe even, I don't know. Gangs of New York, not as good a movie as this.
Great performance.
But tremendous performance. I will say that Leonardo DiCaprio does not hold up as well next
I would
to
agree.
Daniel Day-Lewis
this
as
is
Paul Dano.
This is why Gangs of New York is not as good as There Will Be Blood. It's because of this dynamic is not on equal footing. And Paul Dano brings it.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas Leonardo DiCaprio is, you know, famous for continuing to play himself in period pieces.
Yeah.
Obviously, most famously in Titanic, but also in Gangs of New York, right? And I mean, I like DiCaprio in some stuff. I mean, I love him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Actually, that's probably one of his best performances
of all time. He does not hold up next to
Daniel Day-Lewis, not even remotely. No,
because Daniel Day-Lewis literally looks like that guy, and you think he's Bill the Butcher the whole time.
Right.
And Leonardo DiCaprio, you think is Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, another little fun
it's
story.
True.
And maybe he suffers from being less famous than Paul Dano. But I mean, I will say this, or more famous. Like he's more famous, more recognizable, more of a movie star. But like, Dano. I mean, he is so, like you say, he's so smarmy and hateable, and just
punchable. I think somebody said
punchable, and he completely his dynamic with Daniel Day-Lewis. I mean, really, I mean, the movie is really about those two relationships, right? Plainview's relationship with HW and Plainview's relationship with Eli. And
speaking of, you know,
he pulls it off.
Started this whole conversation with ambiguity about this movie, how ambiguous it is. One of the ambiguities about it that people still discuss to this day, which I think is undercut by this whole idea that Paul Dano wasn't actually cast as the Eli character. But one of the ambiguities is that people discuss is that are Eli and Paul the same person?
I do love a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, that maybe Eli went to Daniel as an alter ego to kind of sell out the whole town so that he can get power.
His exasperation at the end of the film, I think, proves that there is another brother. Like he would have been like, no, that was me.
Eli says to Abel at the dinner table when he's also pissing, yo, Paul told him about it. Your son, Paul. So it was obvious.
That's the big reveal that that's the horror part, right? Is that it's actually the same guy. He's got two personalities.
To this day, people still wonder if they're the same person or if they're supposed to be twins.
That's some Chris Nolan shit.
Exactly.
What does it all really mean? I got to slam Nolan once per podcast.
So Gentlemen,
it's in my contract.
I'm not one to like cut off a conversation at the heels, or and I don't think I've done that.
I knew this was going
to
go long.
But yeah, this has gone quite long. But I wanted to just do my own little summary and then give you both a chance to kind of summarize your experience with the film or something that we haven't necessarily talked about, and then we can continue it a little bit. But I just wanted to emphasize that this has been a great conversation. I think we've really tapped into kind of the characters and what they're arching, you know, symbolism for America and what that representation of for Manifest Destiny and the frontier and the West. And that's what this whole season is about, is understanding this genre as a sort of launching point of a time of history and what that kind of translates into either romanticized ideals or revisionist ideals about the Western, and what that says about human nature, America, or its extension of utilizing landscape and setting to try and tap into something about character and about and about the human experience. And you know, the ideas that, you know, go through this of that about, you know, man versus God or man versus nature, man versus self. And a lot of these are, you know, through lines of themes that happen throughout this genre. And, you know, there's something pretty extraordinary about this film and how it really is one of these operatic embodiments of all these sorts of problems and puts them at kind of a literal Greek tragedy play against each other. These sort of things that have established the American identity and put them on kind of a grand pedestal to fight it out, and which one wins out and why, and what are the haunting elements and reasons for that. And I think we've talked a lot about that issue today. You know, this movie is incredibly cinematic. We didn't even really talk about a lot of the technical feats. You know, Robert Ellsworth's cinematography, which won the Academy Award, is truly exceptional. His use of, you know, anamorphic lenses, the panoramic shots, putting people within the kind of confines of how nature is a daunting place against man, and that somebody like Plainview is what it takes to conquer this land and what it takes to conquer nature, and it's because he has to throw out a lot of things within him, and you know, that are pretty traditional, pretty conventional, pretty understood as being a normal traditional human being in order to do that. And that's what's so, you know, admirable yet kind of haunting and horrifying about the character. He does become a monster, and he becomes a tragic monster, somebody who isolates himself, something that he thought he wanted, and he becomes, you know, a really you know, soulless embodiment and hollowness of what that means, what that desire means. But I would be remiss to not talk about the and just kind of summarize it, that this purely cinematic experience that is a soundscape of experience via Johnny Greenwood's great score.
Oh, I wanted to mention Johnny Greenwood. Yeah.
Well,
unbelievably good score.
Yeah, and it's haunting. The dissonant chords really, you know, really highlight, yeah, what's going on within the character and within the scenes. It's really a complimentary piece. It is an extraordinary piece of score. And Paul Thomas Anderson has a deep love for cinema. And you can see its allusions to Citizen Kane, probably arguably the greatest film ever made, mostly because of how it launched a new kind of idea of what cinematic language was going to be. It's hard to dismiss the power and influence that Citizen Kane had. But really, there's another film from the 40s that this kind of tethers to, and that's Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And that's another film about greed and paranoia and distrust between people. It's a John Huston film, and it has influence on not only the story of what Paul Thomas Anderson in his loose adaptation of Upton Sinclair's book would become kind of an homage to Treasure of the Sierra Madre. He even had Daniel Day-Lewis listen to recordings of John Huston and how he spoke to kind of garner the development of his character, because he saw in him kind of an embodiment of that voice, and that voice within that sense of film. So it has its roots in a traditional kind of Western style and a rumination on what brings characters and what kind of characters it brings to that kind of forefront, and that the the drama of the West and on the frontier. And as a Western, it is a quite an exceptional piece, and I've enjoyed this conversation, but I wanted to give both of you an opportunity to talk about anything or finalize, summarize your experience. Mr. Ben Thalen, anything that you wanted to add to the conversation?
I think you did a really nice job summing it up, and I'm glad you mentioned the Johnny Greenwood score, which is phenomenal and really sort of kind of oscillates back between like weirdness and more conventional sounds in a way that I think really kind of speaks to this, how this is both a very modern movie, but also a movie kind of rooted in tradition, in deep tradition, both the tradition of the Western and movies like Citizen Kane. I would say that, you know, we all, whether we like it or not, right, are the beneficiaries of what these guys did.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
We all sort of live in the world that they forged and enjoy the fruits of, you know, the discovery of petrochemicals, right, and all those things.
I mean, and not only and, that, but also a constant development of progress.
Yes, yes, so. Yeah. And but this was a real tipping point. I mean,
it really
was. You really, yeah. You cannot, the ability to generate that much energy that relatively easy is a huge part of the story of what gets us here with all the nice things that we enjoy, whatever sort of attitudes we might have. And I think that one of the purely cinematic pieces of this movie is just how driven it is, not just by Day-Lewis's performance, but by his physicality, mm-hmm. his humanity, just from a purely physical sense. You hear him breathing all the time. You see him really close. As epic as the movie is in scale, it is very focused on him as a person and as a human that it is not easy to either love or to dismiss or to simply demonize, right? And by having that just incredible focus on him and his physicality and the sort of oscillation between these epic vistas and him, you know, sort of this focus on him, I think that the movie very effectively, just like Citizen Kane, forces us to sort of think about in a very honest, in a very complex, and in a very sort of just full-figured way, kind of what this country is about, who it was built by, and how it was built.
Yeah.
And what it is that underlies the life that you have that, if you can stream this shit on a fucking big screen TV, is probably pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, so I feel like the character, both from an acting perspective and also from a cinematic perspective, is so well realized and well sort of ensconced in this epic backdrop in a way that is just extremely compelling. I mean, this is I don't know if it's not my favorite movie of this century, but it certainly is near the top of the list, and I would commend it to anyone.
Yeah, the performance has degrees of like a primal nature.
And, oh yeah, no, it's a trip. I mean, if it was like Kings of New York, where it was more just about the Daniel Day-Lewis performance, that would still be enough. But it's also like, yeah, I think it's a powerful movie about how, you know, where we were and how we got here.
Yes.
And really engages with, like I said earlier, some of the real core features of American history and culture. So I think it's I think if I were going to make a list of sort of movies to understand America, to understand the USA, this would be on the list.
Absolutely. Archetypal kind of representation of America and putting them on a scale of drama against each other, the religious aspects, the capitalist and self-interest aspects, and how that was kind of in the psyche of the West, and also just the American spirit of that rugged individualism of the West and that expansionism. It was a blend of religious calling, and it was a blend of enlightenment, kind of removal of that we are our own drivers and we are our own engines.
But I mean, and you would have more perspective on this because you're doing the Western series, but it's also a lot about the birth of the 20th century.
For sure. Yeah, especially right? This one in particular.
This particular movie is about how we went from that world to this one.
Yeah.
You know, how we really...
I think, and if he had made the movie about any other topic, really, I don't think it would carry that same weight. But because it's about the beginning of the oil boom, a boom which lasted the entire century and still lives with us today, it really carries that weight.
Yeah,
it
really does. But Mr. Ben Childs, with that, did you have any last thoughts or any ideas to summarize our conversation and experience today?
Well, it's different. I forgot. So here's a little Easter egg. You can plop this in some random part, or save this for an outtake show or whatever. So I have a friend of mine married a woman who was a PA on this movie.
Oh.
And she told me she was mostly working in an office, and apparently there was a deleted scene where, for some reason, Daniel Day-Lewis's, you know, character was explaining why the kid couldn't be his. And the line was, "My cock doesn't even work." And somebody was like watching dailies of that scene. So she's just sitting there in the office, just listening to Daniel Day-Lewis say over and over again in take after take, "My cock doesn't even work."
I tell you, my cock doesn't work.
Doesn't even work. And okay, I can only hope that someday there'll be a Criterion edition of this and that footage survives.
That would be great.
I hope it survives.
Oh, what footage are you referring to?
Apparently there are numerous takes of Daniel Day-Lewis saying, "I tell you, my cock doesn't work," and explaining why his kid, the kid is not his.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying a friend of mine's wife was a PA on this because she lived out in Texas. And so she worked. She worked on a bunch of those Texas movies. You know, a lot That's of like, she worked on this. She worked on a lot of Richard Linklater movies. Oh, great. You know,
so was that written in the script or was that
his? I don't know. I just know that someone was watching dailies of him just saying it over and over again about how his cock doesn't even
work. That answers that question.
And and you know, which makes sense, I guess, because he's a weirdly asexual character.
Oh, yeah,
right.
He's weirdly asexual. I mean,
they show him in a brothel with Henry at one point.
Yeah, he's not doing it.
And he has no desire at all.
He's like your buddy. He's like your buddy who runs out of cash at a strip club. He's like, "I just need to get one more dance, man." Yeah. It played you. I mean, I would say I've been probably on both sides of that coin.
But oddly asexual from the moment we
saw him. But yeah, he has no sexual identity whatsoever.
None. None.
But maybe it's because his cock doesn't even work.
It doesn't even work.
But I just
maybe that's what led him to having to leave Kansas.
Like I was saying, I really hope that footage did not get
deleted.
I hope
entirely.
It's somewhere.
I hope it exists.
Someone will get it. We'll get it in the Criterion edition.
Yeah, I'm still hoping for a Criterion release of this. Full on with behind the scenes.
I'm sure they
audio commentary tracks. Cause
I've never
think of all movies out there.
I've never understood. There must be weird. I mean, I guess it's whoever owns it and whether they want to license it, because I'm sure Criterion would release an edition of this.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's got to just be a matter of
getting
the numbers.
They've only done Punch Drunk Love. I think they'd love to get their hands on his oeuvre.
This one in particular. But they don't. I'm sure it's a lot of politics and a lot of money issues,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
just
sure.
Who gets what and how that deal gets cut. Because
he did do a commentary track on Boogie Nights, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Isn't there
a Criterion on Boogie Nights?
No, not Criterion.
He did a commentary at least.
I think on my double disc feature, there's some commentary.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, there's bonus editions, right? But I just feel like...
Actually, no, this movie doesn't have a commentary track. It might have special features and other things, but I'm still waiting to hear a good commentary track on
There Will Be Blood. For sure. Ben Child, if you wanted to summarize your experience, we're all ears.
Well, this is going to kind of tack on to what you were talking about as a character study. And I think you both brought up Citizen Kane, because I think this ranks up there with Citizen Kane as two of the best character studies in American cinema. I mean, this movie does have peripheral characters. Eli is a great character. H.W. makes her a great character. His little partner, Fletcher, Henry, gets introduced. But he is clearly the focus. And all those characters are really kind of just bounced off of him to kind of see how they react to him. As a character study, it is one of the most brilliant pieces of cinema I've ever seen. Because I don't think I've ever seen a character so well fleshed out in every tiny little detail, through dialogue, through their performance by the actor. Dan Day-Lewis really pulls off one of the most phenomenal performances we've ever seen. To every little quirk of their, the way they look at a character, the way they breathe. You were mentioning breathing, Ben. Every little aspect, the way he interrupts other people, the way he looks at other people when they talk to him. I mean, it is so much of it reveals so many things about him. And it really is such a, just, it's fabulous to watch, just to let it wash over you, you know, this character. And because it's so well done. And not a thing is missing from the performance or from the depiction. And there is so much to be seen in this character in terms of his flaws, in terms of what makes him great. But really, it is his flaws. And because, I mean, we keep getting at, you know, where he arrives at the end. By the end, he's a monster. And it's, and the question arises, you know, what makes him that monster? Is it just his drive? And it's not just his drive. I think it's his ego, really. He puts himself on a pedestal above everyone else. And he even says it outright. He sees very little to like in anybody else. He sees other people very plainly. He has a very plain view of other people, which is why his name is Plainview. And he doesn't want to see anything good in other people, which is, I think, a common trait in many people these days, that they want to see other people as idiots because it makes them feel better about themselves. It makes him a very lonely person. He can't trust anybody. He can't enjoy anything with anybody because he can't trust anyone. He keeps trying to fake it with blood relations. He adopts his son. He kind of adopts a brother, but neither of those work out because in the end, he doesn't love them. He shows love towards HW. He shows compassion. There's times when he's stroking his son's hair, when he's trying to make him feel better after he got injured. There's other moments where he just seems kind of gentle and nice towards HW. But in the end, you see where he arrives with HW and you realize, was there love there? Or was it just him trying to control more people around him? And because I think ultimately he is lonely and he is by himself completely. Mm-hmm. Any relation he had with anybody else by the, you know, throughout the movie, by the end, he's shown that to not be real.
Yeah.
And he is out on an island by himself. And there's no happiness there.
No, none. And he is his own island. I mean, this sort of isolation, I mean, it is sort of, I mean, you're talking about this as a character study, and those are very particular kinds of films, and you have to kind of focus everything that's within the film, even though it's an epic in timeline, even though it has this grandiose spectacle of camera, music, and characters that come in and out, and it surveys a long period of time. It is all rooted in studying this character, and everything's at service and in the focal point of this character. So the music is, those dissonant chords are kind of showing us what's kind of internally going on within the character, or about the outcomes of what the character is willing to do and his drive and ambition. And the fact that he becomes alone, isolated, much like the landscape that is reflected earlier on, he becomes kind of like an embodiment of the frontier. I do agree with you. There's a lack of love, maybe not without his ability to try. Like, I think maybe he has an understanding of what love or connection is, and there's an attempt there. But at the end, he is purely alone. Denied love, and it might be because tragically, because of what drives his character, because of that sort of psychotic, you know, ambition that is so alien to the normal human experience. This is something that is so extraordinary that it's something to be marveled at, but also kind of repelling at the same time. His ability, he might not have the ability to love. And that is at heart kind of the tragedy of this character. The final outcome is that he was inevitably going to be alone. Maybe he wanted that. Maybe he strove to have that. But then it's because he has the incapability and the failure in his life to try.
I mean, if your ego is large enough, you would probably put yourself on the same pedestal as God.
Well,
if you're on the same pedestal as God, there's nobody worthy of your love. And
that's a lonely spot. That's a lonely place.
Underneath you somehow.
Yeah, that's a very, very lonely place.
I get the feeling he puts himself on a pedestal with God. He says he's the third revelation. I don't think he's wrong, actually, because I think in a sense, what capitalism has brought in the 20th century is the equivalent of the third revelation in his eyes. I do get the sense that he sees in himself, in his voice, for instance, the power of God. And he doesn't want to be questioned, just like God doesn't want to be questioned. He doesn't want to be asked about his past, just like, you know, you wouldn't ask God about it. He wants to control that. And he wants to be so successful that nobody can ask him that.
Yeah.
And I definitely see within him that drive of wanting to be that yeah. level of person, basically.
Well, and I mean, that sort of is, but that in a way is kind of the amazing note the movie ends on, right? Which I hadn't really thought about as much as right. I have now, which is that, or this particular aspect of it, which is that the big difference between this and Citizen Kane is this movie ends with a kind of victory.
Yeah.
Right. The story about the guy who gets everything that he wants and then is kind of miserable anyways is an old story. It's well-worn territory, right? But
exactly.
He gets a victory at the end. Maybe you'd say he kills God. I don't know. I mean, in some metaphorical sense. But anyways, what he sees is a great triumph, right?
Yes, yes, he does.
Which is what is, from a structural standpoint, I guess, unique. And I'm not sure what to make of that, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what to make of that, but it is different, right? It's different than this just sort of the pure melancholy of something like Cain, where it's just sad.
Yeah.
It's just sad and lonely.
Right. There's a triumph over, I think, over his what he perceived as his greatest foe, which is somebody who could also kind of control others with their tongue, but in a way that he couldn't.
And what's funny is that victory was
constantly undermined by Eli, by the way Eli could reach the plebeians in a way that he couldn't.
Yeah.
He saw his own workers coming off of the derrick and, you know, falling in line with Eli. And he's like, wow, God damn it. Eli's peeling off my people is how he saw it.
Yeah. But I mean,
I think he definitely saw something in Eli that he didn't have, and he wanted to vanquish that.
Well, and to bring it back to the two philosophers we've mentioned, that might be the thing that would even unite Marx and Nietzsche in their admiration of someone like Plainview, and even in their admiration of capitalism. I mean, it's a myth about Marx that he hates capitalism. He saw capitalism as a very important stage in the development of political economy. He said, like, well, this is the next thing that's going to happen. It's going to bring about a lot of good things. But then, you know, eventually it will destroy itself, as all previous eras have. But whatever you think about that, like, this victory over superstition, right, which is kind of the culmination of his life, right, ultimately,
yeah.
would be seen by many as a triumph, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And sort of as a kind of blow for a more enlightened, rational society, right? Which is what capitalism, for better or worse, does. Is it rationalizes society in a lot of ways?
Yes, like it does.
It makes. I mean, there's but this is a very complex conversation. Very I don't want to open up quote, which was, Pandora's box of it, but like, but I was saying, like, it's notable that he ends
Jesus
with
his final.
Yeah, he ends with a victory, right? He ends with a victory, and it's a victory that.
Yeah, well, that's it.
A lot of people of different stripes would celebrate.
Yeah, I could see that. All the murder is not really what we want to see. But yeah, I guess you want to see the end of something, end of the prior past. But as I say, it ends with, you know, Jesus' final line on the cross was, "It is finished." And his was, "I'm finished."
Hmm.
And it is kind of the end of the end of a Messiah. The last line of a Messiah of his time.
Yeah, well, and it's so interesting that this film, in ending in this way, it has biblical allusions. It has this sort of the symbolic allusions of religion and capitalism fighting it out in the end, and seeing one get snuffed out and sort of digested, almost consumed in the process. Like when he says I'm finished, there's also it's like I'm finished with my dinner. The please take it away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know,
we didn't even talk about him just eating like that fucking desiccated piece of steak. I just thought, like, he's just listening to him holding this just like whatever. I don't even know what I think. I think it's like Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, I hope Paul Thomas Anderson didn't make him do too many takes of that, because yeah, he's taking massive bites.
Oh yeah, just that whole steak. We should stop, because I could talk about that scene forever.
It's fantastic.
Drink your milkshake.
Now we're finally
I drink your milkshake.
I drink my milkshake. No, so I wanted to just kind of summarize. This is a great idea of that. I mean, ego can be God, and he could be. It could be him fully eliminating religion from his life by killing this man, becoming God, becoming the judgment. It could be also the killing of superstition. It could be the idea of capitalism, where the tangible benefits of society consuming that of the untangible and the artificial, if you will. And you can read into it in all sorts of ways. And that's what's so massively impressive about this film, that it balances these characters. It balances this kind of heightened contemplation in a operatic dramatic form. It's an epic of all sorts, and I think just the length of this conversation and the deviations and all the weaving in and out of these characters, what they represent to us, what they represent to the film, I think it's been a massively impressive conversation. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and guys, I think the summations have been great, and I think this is literally the longest episode I've ever done.
Wow. I was hoping it would be.
Boom.
Yeah, this is the. I think even Boom.
I'm gonna get another milkshake.
Yeah, get another milkshake. I have to get you another milkshake. We did drink milkshakes. I didn't bring it up until now. And Ben Childs had whiskey, which is Plainview's actual drink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's I think it's the
only
thing he drinks.
He doesn't even drink water.
actually, he drinks water, I think, once in the final sequence.
That very last scene where he just downs a half a thing of water. You can tell he's been drinking whiskey all night. That's why.
Or maybe it was Aquavit, for all I know. Right?
Mr. Ben Thalen, popcorn optional. Developing and
it's coming.
I'm excited. I'm on it.
You're on it.
I'm already excited. I can't wait to be on more if you're gonna have me. But
you're slated.
Oh, good. That's fantastic. Well, look for popcorn optional. Mr. Ben Thalen has been a great source of knowledge and conversation on this, and I'm looking forward to venturing his own show because. It's probably more interesting than mine. So.
Oh, come on. I mean, the episodes I'm on for you are good. So
yeah, that's very fair. It's 100% true. Mr. Ben Childs, just being in quarantine, any music or just movie watching now that we're doing this?
Just movie watching and podcasting with you. That and working full time.
Well, I mean, it's a blessing to have work during this time. So, you know, I cherish it, and I'm not ignorant to it's sort of blessings.
What you really
want to
do is marry someone who has a good job.
There you go.
Yeah,
that's the route I've taken.
I'd be the
kept man route
for sure. I'd be a great stay at home dad and cook. I'm a great cook.
Yeah, no, that's like, true. So, it's true. And, true story.
So I'm looking forward to that those years of my life. So yeah,
well, I'm rooting for you, buddy.
Well, thank you.
I'm rooting for you. How's that working out?
I mean, no children as of yet, but
you gotta put a kid in them. Yeah, because once you do that, they gotta fucking deal with you. Then you drink their milkshake.
Then I drink their milkshake.
That's right, because they can't fucking be rid of you.
Well, this is a good plan. I'm getting the best advice right now. So,
exactly.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for this conversation. This has been so good, and I've relished every minute of it. And for those listening, thank you for joining. I Know Movies, and you don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Brule, and we'll see you later.